Today on The Journey.
Men, sexual intimacy is not just about a physical act. Especially for women, there is the need to be told over and over how beautiful they are, how much you love them. This is the one just for you, a mare among stallions.
Remember those easy summer nights cruising with your boy or girlfriend, listening to classic love songs playing on the radio? Do you remember their messages about love and sex? Would you want your son or daughter following their philosophy? Well, today, we have an oldie but goodie for you. One written not only for new love, but for your love too. And in its lyrics, you'll find sexual instruction everyone can live by. Ron Moore shares it in just a moment. Also, we're offering for a gift of any amount, Ron's booklet, Created for Oneness. It offers a biblical framework for marriage and sexuality. This is a must-have resource in our post-Christian culture. You can get your copy by calling 724-731-2018. Your gift today will help further this ministry of developing followers of Jesus Christ. Now, Ron comes to share the Song of Songs in part two of the message, God's Idea, the Gift, on the Journey.
We are going to look at not just one of the great love songs of all time, but we're going to look at the greatest love song ever written. It's recorded in the Old Testament, and it is called the Song of Songs, or the greatest song. It's a song about God's gift of sexual intimacy between a man and a woman in the context of marriage. This inspired book of God pulls no punches regarding sex, but it is in no way crude or vulgar. Instead, through exquisite poetry, it describes this beautiful gift of God. Now, this book is written by Solomon. And granted, Solomon, with his many wives and concubines, does not qualify him to be the best example of love and marriage. However, God uses this man who had experienced what love was not to teach us what love is. One commentator said, "The experiences recorded in this book may reflect the only pure romance that Solomon ever had." What I want to do is just to hit the highlights as we work our way through this song. I want to introduce it to you and bring out four critical points about biblical sexuality. I want to set a compelling context of why sexuality in marriage is the only way to go. So find the Song of Songs in your Bible and turn to chapter 8. Now, if you have an NIV or a study Bible, they have helped you out, and they will have three speakers: the beloved, who is the woman, the lover, who is the man, and friends, who are either friends of the bride and groom or, in this case, brothers. And here we see a critical point that we've been trying to hit all along. And the point is this: the training for an understanding of biblical sexuality is the family's responsibility. Look at verse 8 of chapter 8. The brothers say, "We have a young sister and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for?" Here's a clear reference to a very young girl, and the question of her family is, what's our responsibility? What will we do for her? How can we prepare her for God's gift? How can we prepare her for that day she's engaged and married? Look at verse 9. "If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her." Now, a wall was around every city. It was the fortification for that city. It was built strong. No one could penetrate the city because of the wall. If she is a wall, if she stands firm against the advances of men, then we will build towers of silver on her. The tower in every city was a place of honor, a place of respect, a place of confidence. The tower was the place they hung all the implements of battle on. When an army was getting ready to go to battle, they would go to the tower and they would get their shields and their swords and their spears. So when you walked by that tower, you would see all those implements of war and you would say, man, I am confident. That's a place of respect. It's a place of honor. It's a place where confidence is built. So if she is like a wall, if she stays pure, we will build towers of silver on her. We will honor her. We will encourage her. We will help her. We will support her because we know she's headed the right way. But look at verse 9, the second part. If she is a door, if she is open to the advances of men, remember this is poetry, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. If she is promiscuous, then we will put restrictions on her, not to hurt her, but to protect her from hurting herself prior to marriage. Do you hear what this family is saying? As she matures, as she becomes sexually aware, and she demonstrates she can handle the responsibility, man, we'll encourage her. Way to go. We're here for you. But if she shows herself to be promiscuous, then we will set the standards around her. Ages of dating, responsibilities, time to be in. We will set those to her. Now, this type of discipline and this type of encouragement is not easy. It takes time. It takes energy. It takes effort. The young woman may not even appreciate it. But the family says, we love her too much to let her hurt herself in this area. And we will do everything we can to help her out. Now, do you think those restrictions are mean or loving? When I was growing up, we had kind of right between our living room and dining room, a floor furnace, literally on the floor. And it was hot. The heat would come up. A guy here last night came up after, and he said, we had a furnace just like that. And when my sister was 2 years old, she walked over that furnace and burned her foot really bad. The grid of that furnace is still today, many, many years later, on her foot. And we had one of those, and it was hot. So what my dad did was this. He either built or bought kind of an accordion-type fence. And in the winter, when that furnace was on, he put that fence around the furnace. Now, was he mean or loving? Well, I think the latter. He loved us enough, he was going to keep us away from that fire because he didn't want us to be burned. So when a family puts the right restrictions on a person growing up, they love them. Now, all the restrictions doesn't guarantee a thing, does it? There comes a time when the person has to say, I am going to follow through God's way. And look what this woman does in verse 10. She says, I am a wall. I am strong. I will not compromise in that area. And she says, my breasts are like towers. This is not a physical description. This is poetry. Remember what towers are? The place of respect, place of honor. She's saying, my womanhood, my maturity gives me self-respect and I get respect from other people as well. Isn't that beautiful? You see, self-esteem, young men and women, is when you do things God's way. That's how you get God's esteem for yourself. And here this woman says, I have self-respect. I can hold my head high. I can walk down the street. I have self-respect and people respect me for the standards that I have. And then she goes on to say, thus I have become in his eyes like the one bringing contentment. I'm going to stand before my one day husband and I'm going to bring him contentment. There's not going to be any baggage from ex-lovers or liaisons or one night stands. I'm a wall and I will bring contentment to his eyes. Turn to chapter 1. We begin this book with courtship. The man and the woman have narrowed the field down to one. They're serious about each other. And here we see that courtship involves disciplined sexual desire. Look at verse 2. The woman says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfume. Your name is like a perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. Now, although the bride does not hide her emotions, she is depending on the man to take the lead. Although she desires his kisses, she does not initiate them. Let him kiss me. Now, she is no wet rag in the relationship. She clearly communicates her desires, and she does it passionately and clearly. But she expects him to take the leadership that God ordained. Man, you got to take the leadership. And one of the things the man does throughout this book, he tells her over and over again how much he loves her, how beautiful she is. Look at verse 9, one of the first instances. He says, I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Now, the chariots of Pharaoh were pulled by stallions. And he says, I liken you to a mare among the stallions. When I look out there, you're like one in a million. You're the only one I see. And man, you create a chaos among those stallions. Every man would want you to be his wife. I can't imagine why anyone would not want you. How lucky I am. You are a mare among the stallions. Now, in this time of courtship, I don't want us to miss the strong sexual desire that they have for each other. This is normal and this is natural. They want to be sexually involved. Look at chapter 2, verse 3. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Look at chapter 2, verse 10. He responds, my lover spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come away with me. He goes on to say, the winter is past, the spring is coming. Let's go away. There is strong sexual desire. But remember, she's a wall. And that same principle applies to the young man as well. And so they say, we got to be careful in this area. Although there's natural, normal sexual desire in this courtship, we got to be extremely careful. Look at chapter 2, verse 15. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. You hear what they're saying? We got to be really careful. Now, what would some of those little foxes be in a relationship that might come in and ruin things? Things like mistrust, jealousy, planning the wedding, cutting down the guest list, those types of things. But certainly one would be undisciplined desire. See, the wedding's almost here. We're going to get married anyway. We're going to spend our lives together. Why wait? And the wall becomes a door. And the guilt and disappointment replace the excitement and expectation. Because when you don't do it God's way, you lose. So the bride-to-be says in chapter 3, verse 5, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Let's keep the boundaries up around that fire. Oh, what an important reminder to anyone in that courtship stage. Be careful. Put the restrictions there. Courtship's finally over. Now it's game day. It's showtime. Solomon shows up with his carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the best of all Israel. The new groom has nothing but praise for his wife. He continues to tell her how beautiful she is and how much he desires her. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Chapter 4, verse 9. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. Now, again, we won't take time to go through all the verses where Solomon tells his wife how beautiful she is. But men, here's an important thing to learn, isn't it? Sexual intimacy is not just about a physical act. Especially for women, there is the need to be told over and over and over and over again how beautiful they are, how much you love them. This is the one just for you, a mare among stallions. Not as a lead up to what you want, but the emotion of your heart that you have the one God made just for you. And here on their wedding night, Solomon praises her for saving herself just for him. Look at verse 12. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. He praises her for her purity. And then that night, they consummate
the relationship. I want you to listen to this beautiful description. No vulgarity or crude language. Just the poetic beauty of sex the way God intended. Look at chapter 4, verse 16. She says, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow in my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits." And he says, "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk." What a beautiful description of what the world makes so crude and vulgar. You see, here's my next point. The wedding night is worth waiting for. It begins what is meant to be a continued intimacy and fulfillment. And that, young people, provides a compelling reason to wait. Two people who respect themselves enough to save themselves come together on their wedding night with no baggage. Well, this is a real marriage. And so there are some problems in this marriage. How the wife and husband handle the problems will determine the longevity and the satisfaction of the marriage. The lovers in the Song of Solomon are no exceptions. And the problems that come in many marriages have to do with sex, and the couple here in Song of Solomon is no different. There's a time when she becomes indifferent, and his pride is wounded, and he runs away. Look at verse 2 of chapter 5. This is the woman talking. "I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night." And then listen to what she says. "I've taken off my robe. Must I put it back on? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again? Not tonight." And she finally gets up, but it's too late. His wounded pride causes him to run. Here it happens literally. In many of our lives, it happens emotionally as a husband and wife disconnect with each other in this beautiful, powerful part of their relationship. In verse 6, she says, "I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer." Now, she looks for him throughout chapter 5. She finds him in chapter 6, and in chapter 7, they resume the gift that God has given them. But some marriages don't have a chapter 5 and chapter 6 and chapter 7. They stay at that indifferent, wounded pride stage. Our fourth point is this. God designed sex to unite a husband and a wife, not divide them. And if there are issues in your married life regarding sex, it's not the way God intended it to be. And you got to be man enough and woman enough to deal with it, or it will continue to drive an ungodly wedge in your relationship. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3. "The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourself to prayer, and then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Do you hear what Paul's saying? In a marriage relationship, there is a responsibility to each other. There is a sexual drive that God Himself instilled. And there is a responsibility for that drive to be fulfilled within the marriage relationship.
And so the wife is to meet the needs of the man, and the man is to meet the needs of the wife, and they are to come together to do what God intended them to do, meet each other's needs. Why? So Satan may not tempt you. You see the powerful area this is in our life. If it's not taken care of in the marriage, then we are just opening ourselves to Satan's temptations. Now, I believe our culture has just sold us a lie, and we have bought it. Our culture says that sex should be earth-shattering, chandelier-swinging, mind-blowing every time. Married couples, we need a proper expectation of everyday, ordinary married sex. Sometimes it is chandelier swinging, but there is a beauty in its ordinariness. There is a beauty, isn't there, meeting the needs of each other. It is with the person we love, the person we have fun with, the person we have children with, the person who knows how weird we are and loves us anyway. This is about invested life. That's what makes it so specially, beautifully ordinary in the context of the marriage relationship.
And please stay with us. Ron returns in a few moments with a preview of our next broadcast. Do you remember the traditional standard in marriage and family? It used to be a man and a woman marrying, having a family, and for better or worse, joined as one as long as they both should live. Today, that standard is in tatters. In the United States, 50% of all marriages end in divorce. Many couples in our country have concluded that living together before matrimony makes good sense. And Americans are deeply divided over the issue of same-sex marriage. Not surprisingly, those conflicts are challenging Christian belief. So in order to contend for biblical marriage, we first must understand what the Bible has to say about it. Only when its truth is fully grasped will we have the confidence to pass it on to our children and grandchildren. To help you with that, Ron Moore has written the booklet, Created for Oneness. It offers a biblical framework for marriage and sexuality. We'll send it to you for a gift of any amount when you visit ronmoore.org. Again, that web address is ronmoore.org. Or you may call 724-731-2018. That's 724-731-2018. Now here's Ron with a look at our next time together.
When sex, meant to fulfill and complete, is depersonalized, it leaves the experience of sex unfulfilling and empty. Whether it's fantasy or porn or wandering eye, whatever it is, when you go into that area and you stay there, then when you come back into real life, who can compete with fantasy? And so the real experience is not what God intended it to be. C.S. Lewis is a great Christian writer, and many years ago, back in the 40s, he wrote a tremendous book called The Screwtape Letters. If you've not read it, read it. It's a senior devil instructing a junior devil in the art of temptation. Great read. Now listen to what the senior devil tells the junior devil about temptation. Never forget that when we are dealing with any pleasure in its healthy and normal and satisfying form, we are on the enemy's, God's, ground. When it's pleasure, it's God's ground. All we can do is to encourage the humans to take the pleasures which our enemy has produced at times or in ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. Hence, we always try to work away from the natural condition of any pleasure to that in which it is least natural and least pleasurable. An ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure is the formula.
We hope you can join us for that message next time. Also, please remember to get your copy of Ron's booklet, which shares a biblical framework for marriage and sexuality. It's titled Created for Oneness, and it's yours for a gift of any amount when you visit ronmoore.org. Again, that web address is ronmoore.org. Or you may call 724-731-2018. That's 724-731-2018. Plus, we invite you to have a look at our church website at biblechapel.org. There you'll find information about our worship services and special events, along with Ron Moore's recent sermons, devotional thoughts, and podcasts. Again, that address is biblechapel.org, biblechapel.org. And if the journey has made a difference in your spiritual life, won't you invite your friends and family to listen as well? We'll thank you, and we think they will too. Finally, please keep in mind that the journey relies on your generous donations. Your gift today will be deeply appreciated. You can give at ronmoore.org, or you may call 724-731-2018. Thanks for listening, and we invite you to join Ron and Tunch next time as we walk together on The Journey.